This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. And just a month ago, many of us were cozying up with the family, watching Hallmark movies, eating leftovers, and hopefully taking it at least a little easy from work and the stress of the pandemic. But as soon as the clock struck January 1st, it was all about the resolutions. New year, new you. And in the U.S., there's one goal that's often near the top of the list. According to the database company Statista, nearly half of Americans who responded to a 2020 poll said they wanted to lose weight as their 2021 New Year's resolution. Now, some of that mindset could be because throughout the year, we're bombarded with commercials about the best new diet trend, juice cleanses, weight loss supplements, and exercise equipment.
You look amazing.
Jenny Craig works.
Keto doesn't have to be hard. Just use Keto Chow.
Peloton, give it up for our first time ride.
All right, first ride. I'm a little nervous, but excited. Let's do this.
45 million Americans go on a diet each year. And Americans spend over $70 billion a year on diet and health products. And this isn't new. Y'all remember SlimFast?
The plan is easy. A shake for breakfast, one for lunch, and a sensible dinner. Even a candy bar is a snack. And if it works for me, it can work for you.
But even if you're able to lose weight on something like SlimFast, a vast number of these fad diets fail to meet the elusive goal of long-lasting weight loss. Okay, pause. Put your phone down. Don't tweet at me just yet, because this is not a conversation about how to lose weight. And I promise, if you stick with us, we're even going to talk about the weight-related stigma, body shaming, and fat hate that has real effects on people's lives. But we're going to start, just for now, with an assumption that weight loss is a journey that at least some people want or feel they need to take. It's a bit like some people are going to travel to the Grand Canyon or to Disneyland. Now, I might think one of those destinations is better than the other, but I'm just going to start by first asking about the challenges someone might face while trying to get where they want to go. And right now, getting on the diet industry train to try to get to the Grand Canyon of weight loss is one expensive, uncertain, and bumpy ride. For decades, pharmaceutical companies have been trying to develop medications that could make the weight loss journey more comfortable and direct. But for the most part, weight loss drugs have been a little bit more like the Hot Mess Express. In the 1990s, the popular FDA-approved drug known as Fen-Phen was pulled from the market due to concerns over serious heart valve complications. Today, there are new options. A class of weight loss drugs called GLP-1s that could help patients lose from 5 to 15% of their body weight. And these medicines are less invasive than surgery, and they come without some of those red flag side effects of their predecessors. The problem? Many doctors aren't prescribing them, and insurance companies aren't covering them yet. So I spoke with Emma Court, health reporter at Bloomberg News, about this new weight loss drug. And I asked her about some of the history and science behind weight and weight loss.
We know that obesity specifically is tied to higher risk of various sort of other health conditions, including things like diabetes. It's called all-cause mortality. It's essentially death from any cause. So these are some of the data that have been used to sort of draw this connection between higher weights using the BMI scale and, you know, concerns about health and desire to help people lose weight to help improve their health.
And yet weight loss is not just hard. I mean, if I were looking at the data alone and saying, okay, is this a thing I should spend my time on because it's likely, I'm likely to get the outcome I want by, you know, putting time and energy and effort into it. I'd have to say, really, climb a mountain instead, like do almost anything, because it feels like meaningful and lasting weight loss does feel nearly impossible.
Meta-analyses, like big analyses of multiple studies have found that, well, actually, many people can lose weight in the short term. And in fact, probably many listeners here are like, wait, I've lost weight, right? What's so hard about it? You know, it's extremely difficult in the long term to keep that weight off. The vast majority of people end up regaining weight. And so we know from the research that this is not just a difficult thing, but you're almost defying the odds by succeeding in keeping weight loss off in over a period of years.
When we have physical ailments, challenges, things that actually challenge our health, you know, pharmaceuticals and surgical interventions are kind of the Western medical gold standard for addressing those things that impact our health. Has that also been true for weight loss?
Many people by now are pretty familiar with surgery as an intervention for weight loss, and it's bariatric surgery encompasses a lot of different approaches, but essentially even that is pretty underused. It's something that many people qualify for, but for various reasons, especially the issue of cost, it's a surgery that can cost about $20,000, and insurance doesn't always pay for it or can require you to jump through various kind of hoops in order to qualify, including, by the way, like sometimes losing weight, which is interesting. But, you know, my piece really looks at pharmaceuticals, which are also very underutilized. And in fact, a lot of people who struggle with their weight their entire lives and are told repeatedly by medical providers that they should lose weight, it would be better for their health, are not informed about the very doctors who are, you know, telling them that weight is an issue and could prescribe them medications in order to help, you know, are not doing that. And so we actually know that only about 1-3% of people who qualify for prescription medications for weight loss are actually getting prescribed them, which is a pretty stunning figure. And actually many overweight people and all people who are living with obesity qualify for prescriptions for these medications. So, you know, the disconnect between these two things can seem sort of stupefying, but the reality is that many doctors, you know, aren't necessarily aware of these medications, may not be comfortable prescribing them, are concerned about side effects, which is a totally valid concern. And another piece of this is sort of the general lack of awareness about this, the broad feeling that weight loss medications are, you know, maybe a little bit sketchy, right? There's a history of safety problems with these medications. People may recall Fen-Phen, there was sort of a safety scandal about this combination of medications causing heart damage in the 90s. So there's kind of a lot of different pieces that add up here to mean that people are rarely offered these medications and rarely take them. But, you know, that may be changing now. And part of the reason for that is that makers of weight loss medications are now starting to see some much more promising approaches to these interventions. So kind of some older medications in this space are thought to only help people lose about 5% to 10% of their body weight using these medications. And now newer drugs, like one drug from Novo Nordisk that's called Wegovy that was approved by the FDA last summer, is actually able to help people lose about 15% of their body weight on average.
But here we have prescription medications that do seem, even the ones that there's been a critique about, we're still talking about potentially 5% of body weight, which could be game changing when we're talking about comorbidities like, for example, diabetes. So in that space, is it like a moral and ethical, like you should just be able to get on that Peloton and lose that weight by working hard? Or is it legitimate fear on the part of physicians about overprescribing?
Well, an important kind of context for having this discussion is the fact that obesity hasn't traditionally been thought of necessarily as a medical issue. This got a lot of attention about 8 years ago. The American Medical Association declared obesity a disease. And while it's been described as a disease for many years, including by a group of experts convened by the NIH back in, you know, the 90s, this isn't something that's necessarily permeated our collective understanding of weight, right? Like in general, I think many people continue to think of it as an issue of willpower. And that many people includes, by the way, medical providers, right? Like we're all human beings, including people who went to medical school. It wasn't necessarily a part of the way that they were trained. And you're starting to see kind of more doctors come out getting these certifications in obesity, but there's still not that many of them relative to sort of how many people might benefit from seeing an obesity doctor.
I can remember in the 70s and 80s that much of what was presented as weight loss drugs were these kind of over-the-counter, non-prescription. And what they were was like uppers, right? This was a lot of caffeine in a small pill. And the notion was, you know, take this and it will make you, you know, less hungry. And, you know, I can remember folks feeling jittery and, you know, unable to concentrate and all of those kinds of things. But that's really different than what's going on with, for example, Wegovy. You want to talk a little bit about how Wegovy ends up out here on the market as a prescription weight loss drug? Because it's not how it started.
Wegovy is part of a broader group of medications. They're known as GLP-1 receptor agonists, and they are named that because they replicate the effects of a satiety hormone that's known as GLP-1. So these are drugs that are actually best sort of known for their applications in diabetes. What they do is sort of prompt your pancreas to release insulin and help bring blood glucose levels down. And so this is how they've been used for a long time. The first of these class of drugs was approved by the FDA in about 2005. But they also knew, even as they were sort of developing these drugs, that they did seem to help people lose weight as well. Both some of the earlier generation of these diabetes drugs, they were helping people lose weight, but only kind of a little bit, right? Like a couple percentage points. And as they started sort of developing different formulations of that and higher doses, they saw that they were able to produce more weight loss.
It's my understanding what's going on with Wegovy at the moment is that it's available to be prescribed and that there is a huge demand for it. That demand is actually having some trouble getting filled, in part because of all the supply chain problems, but also that that the nature of the availability of it also is that health insurance plans are currently not covering it. Is that right? I'm just trying to think about some of the other barriers here, because it's my understanding it's quite expensive and health insurance isn't covering it, and yet we still have this big demand.
The kinds of results that Novo Nordisk has gotten with Wegovy in these research trials, the 15% weight loss, it's gotten a lot of people interested, right? And so you saw a lot of demand from that initial launch. And that's one aspect of this. Another piece of this puzzle is the fact that insurance companies generally haven't been covering weight loss medications. And that hasn't been such an issue for some of the older drugs that are actually used off label. They're medications that are widely prescribed by obesity doctors that are pretty cheap generic medications, and they don't cost all that much. And so they haven't been explicitly approved by the FDA for weight loss, by the way, but they're used and they're generally considered pretty safe. And obesity doctors say they know how to prescribe them. And this is actually drugs like phentermine, which was part of that fen-phen equation back in the day, and is actually the most commonly prescribed weight loss medication up to this point. So these are pretty cheap medications. Wegovy is not a cheap medication. It's about $1,400 for a month's supply. It's a weekly shot, so that's about four of these injectors that they sell. And how exactly insurance coverage is going to shake out for Wegovy is kind of still to be determined. They used to kind of think of it as a lifestyle medication alongside stuff like, you know, erectile dysfunction medications and smoking cessation products. So how that changes is very much up in the air. But I spoke with insurers, and it did seem like they were watching this.
Fascinating, all of it. Emma Court is a health reporter for Bloomberg News. Thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
There's another side of this conversation to consider, whether we should be pursuing weight loss as a goal at all. Large bodies are typically defined in our society as problematic bodies. And the people with large bodies are assumed to be lazy, greedy, or just inadequately motivated. They're not working hard enough to look the way that someone else wants and expects them to look. And maybe you've noticed there is more than a little fat shaming going on around COVID-19, obesity, and mortality, as if getting ill and dying during a multi-year global pandemic could be fixed with just a few more hours on the Nordic Trek.
that is really part and parcel of how we think about people of size, about fat people in American culture. They are the one acceptable group that we still think it is widely okay to discriminate against, to say negative things about, because we have this overarching idea that fatness is a choice and that it is an unhealthy choice that folks are making because they lack self-control.
Now that's Brittany Cooper, a professor at Rutgers University and author of Eloquent Rage, A Black Feminist Discovers Her Superpower. Back in August, I spoke to Professor Cooper about the pervasiveness of body shaming and fat phobia, especially around Black women and celebrities like Lizzo. And today, we didn't want to have a conversation about weight loss without also talking about a movement that reminds us losing is not always winning.
So the fat acceptance movement is pretty simple. It's the belief that all humans, regardless of body shape, deserve the same amount of respect.
Now that's
Paula Atkinson. I am a body liberation focused psychotherapist, and I'm a professor at George Washington University, where I teach a course about body justice called Weight and Society.
Takeaway producers spoke with Paula about her work.
I myself am in recovery from an eating disorder. My body has been very, very large and my body has been very, very small. I have done a lot of terrible things to my body in the pursuit of thinness and acceptance. And I became a psychotherapist wanting never, ever to touch eating disorders or body hatred with a 10-foot pole. And then I found myself unable to stay away because I felt so strongly about the fact that I myself had been brainwashed to believe that I would be a more valuable person were my body a different size. And then to watch other people suffer within that same illusion made me crazy. So it turned out the only way to be sane was to get really angry and become an activist in body justice and helping other people free themselves from the belief that weight equals worth.
Now, Paula works with other psychotherapists to help them look at their own biases and how those biases affect their interactions with their clients. She says mental health professionals need to take the lead to prevent a lot of weight-related stigma.
This idea that a large body is an indication of insufficient willpower, lack of discipline, inability to make good choices, that a body shape indicates poor character. Clinicians, mental health professionals, tend to diagnose people in large bodies with more severe mental health issues. And it's kind of insane when you think about it, that a body shape would indicate somebody's mental health, other than the fact that body shape does indicate somebody's mental health, because a person in a large body has to deal with the stigma of living in a large body every single day.
And visiting a doctor's office can also be traumatic for someone in a larger body. Medical equipment, gowns, and chairs may not fit their bodies, and they may have to deal with weight bias from their doctor, too.
The amount of vitriol and bias and hate that they receive from medical professionals, again, medical professionals who are supposed to be helping all people get quote-unquote healthier, is really sad. It's really awful. We have been taught that obesity, again, quote unquote, is a disease that should be cured. However, there is no cure. There is no sustainable, maintainable way to make a big body into a small body. And study after study after study shows that nothing can sustainably, reliably turn a big body into a small body. And yet when somebody's in a big body and they go to a doctor's office, the doctor tells them, do it, make your body smaller. It's pretty insane.
So if your New Year's resolution is still about trying to fit into an old pair of jeans or just attempting to make choices that you feel are healthier, Paula has some advice on that.
Study after study after study shows that if you actually want to be quote unquote healthier, the best thing to do is to not focus on your weight, is to not focus on the number on the scale, is to not focus on your body shape. You know, something that I talk about a lot is to shift the perspective from my experience, my internal experience of living in this body versus somebody else's experience of looking at my body, that's what's going to create the most amount of health. So what foods feel good? What movement feels good? What rest feels good inside? So my internal experience of living in this body is more important than your experience of looking at it. That's the best way to actually attain health.
It's also important to remember, especially in this country, that there are many socioeconomic barriers to health. And rather than casting judgment, Paula suggests this approach.
Health is not a characterological thing either. Whether or not somebody is healthy, quote unquote, or not healthy, everybody deserves the same amount of respect. This idea that everybody has equal access to health is nonsense, right? There's a lot of people that cannot be quote unquote healthy, no matter how hard they try or how they put their nose to the grindstone. So yes, fat people can be healthy. Of course they can. And also maybe not everybody can be healthy, but that doesn't mean that they don't deserve the same amount of respect and love and compassion.
That was psychotherapist Paula Atkinson, professor at George Washington University. And this is The Takeaway.
One, two, one, two.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and you're listening to The Takeaway. If you're anything like me, you've amassed quite the collection of face masks over the past 2 years.
M to the A to the S to the K, put the mask on the face just to make it next day.
N95s, medical grade masks, cloth masks, you name it, I've probably got it. In light of the highly transmissible Omicron variant, it's become even more important that we mask up. But not all masks are equally effective. The CDC is currently considering updating its guidance on masking to encourage people to wear the more protective KN95 and N95 masks. For more on this, I spoke with Dr. Lisa Marigakis, professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and senior director of healthcare epidemiology and infection prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System. I asked Dr. Marigakis to remind us about how masks prevent COVID-19 from spreading.
Masks are a physical barrier that helps to contain respiratory droplets that can be expelled not only when you're coughing or sneezing, but also when you're just having a conversation with somebody, you know, and particularly if you're speaking loudly or singing. And so that mask stops those respiratory droplets from carrying virus from one person to the next.
How important is it, though, that even for folks who are vaccinated, that we continue wearing masks?
It is so important. And Melissa, you raise some issues that are so important to talk about, because I think confusion and fatigue and politicization of this issue have all made it extremely hard for us to make the right choices and continue over the long period of time wearing masks and doing the things, the very simple things that help keep us safe. And so it is unfortunate, but we even had national guidance come out in May of this year saying that if you were vaccinated, you no longer had to wear a mask. There was a lot of optimism around that time that the pandemic was coming to an end, that rates were falling, and that masks were no longer necessary. Many in infection prevention, like myself, were very upset by that guidance at the time. It's certainly understandable that everyone was tired of wearing the masks, but I really look at infection prevention as a package of layers of protection that we can put together, including the vaccine, which is so incredibly helpful to prevent severe disease and death. But then the infection prevention measures like masking and washing our hands and some of the choices about indoor gatherings while the virus is still so prevalent.
Okay. Walk us through what kind of masks we should be wearing and how we should be wearing them. And if it really matters what kind of mask we're wearing.
The good news is that many different kinds of masks can be effective. There are some features of masks that are important, and you may have heard these at the beginning of the pandemic, but I think maybe messages have gotten a little bit muddled or forgotten. But it is important that a mask have multiple layers that helps trap those respiratory droplets and viral particles and prevent them from being transmitted. And so if you have a mask that is multiple layers and well-fitting, it will be more effective. We've heard a lot of talk in recent days about cloth masks being worthless. And I really beg to differ about that. If they're well-constructed, multiple layers, and well-fitting, these are very effective tools that we have. And it's the easiest and most inexpensive way to really protect ourselves when we're going out into public places. So a cloth mask is very good for most situations. You want to avoid masks that have exhalation valves. Those are those valves that make it easier to breathe, but unfortunately also easier for viral particles to get through. And avoiding things like single layer material that might be found in a gaiter, or any kind of mask that has holes in it or gaps around the side.
Should we wash our cloth masks? And if we do, should we dry them or hang them on the line?
This is a step that is frequently skipped, and I must admit I do so myself, but it is important to wash your mask. You can imagine that they do get dirty being so close to your mouth and nose all day. So washing a mask, you can either wash it in the machine or by hand, and it really doesn't need to be any particular type of drying, but just making sure that you clean it and that you get it dry. Either way, on a line or in a dryer works.
Now, what about the sort of, let's call them high quality but disposable masks, right? Should we wear them only once, or can you wear those, you know, Monday and Tuesday, or maybe even all week?
Well, if you're talking about the over-the-counter masks that look more like the medical masks, the rectangular pieces of kind of accordion folded layers of material. Sometimes they're blue or green or white. These are also very effective. Medical grade masks have a degree of fluid resistance to them that is very helpful to us in healthcare, where you are in close proximity to patients and may encounter respiratory droplets directly onto your mask. So those can be helpful. Interestingly, the sides of those rectangles tend to gap even more than some of the well-made cloth masks. And there are some strategies that can be used to tie the elastic bands or ties to and kind of tuck the sides in to help improve the fit.
And this is my last question is prompted by your point about the physical distancing. I think sometimes, again, that 6 feet can feel like some sort of magical number. As though if we're 6 feet away, that alone will protect us. But help us to understand what the distancing means and how protective it is for us.
You're so right. There's nothing magical around 6 feet. It really arose from studies of coughing and sneezing and trying to determine the distance that respiratory droplets with viral particles will travel before they fall to the floor. But if you look at that literature, even that falls flat because powerful coughs and sneezes can propel respiratory droplets much further than 6 feet. So it's a rough guideline, and we know that in many settings like schools, with the class sizes, even 6 feet is not possible at times.
I don't know. I guess I have one more question. Is this ever going to be over? The vaccines made me so excited to be with people again, to teach my students in person again. And it feels like we're right back at the beginning.
You know, so much of this is feeling oppressive and quite frankly, depressing at times, but we will come out the other side of this. I have no doubt. Infectious disease and infection prevention persons like myself know that the winter is respiratory virus season, and we have anticipated that we would have a surge. We didn't know it would be this large or this transmissible. But here we are, and we will come out of the other side of it. We are so much better positioned now with the knowledge that we have, with the vaccines that we have. I would encourage everyone to get vaccinated, get your booster, and to have some patience with these very basic measures like masking and washing hands and distancing and making safer choices about our social interactions, certainly over the next several months. And I do see that we will have brighter days ahead.
Dr. Lisa Marigakis is the Senior Director of Healthcare Epidemiology and Infection Prevention with the Johns Hopkins Health System. Dr. Marigakis, thanks for being here and for making me feel a little better.
Thanks for having me.
Grand Slam season is just days away, and players are getting set to serve at the Australian Open next week. But this year, the tournament's reigning champion, Novak Djokovic, is not getting the welcome he wanted. You see, Novak is no vaxxed. And he tried to get into Australia with a medical exemption, but was put in quarantine with a revoked visa instead. A judge overruled that decision, and now Australian officials are fighting to keep him off the court. Here's what Novak's dad said earlier this month.
Novak and his team filed the same type of documents as those 25 other tennis players, and they didn't have any problems, just Novak. They wanted to humiliate him. They could have said, "Don't come, Novak," and that would have been okay. But no, they wanted to humiliate him.
But Novak's opposition to vaccines isn't unique among star athletes. Last summer, Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers lied to reporters on his vaccination status during the NFL preseason by telling people he was immunized. But on a recent visit on the Pat McAfee show, he said that league officials knew about his situation.
The league was fully aware of it upon my return to the Packers. And it was at that point that I petitioned them to accept my immunization status as under their vaccination protocol.
He received a $14,000 fine for violating the league's COVID protocols. Chump change for an NFL star player like him. Now, Kyrie Irving of the Brooklyn Nets, on the other hand, was out for the start of the NBA season because of his refusal to get vaccinated. But ironically, his team reactivated him last month to play away games after injuries and COVID protocols caused other players to miss games. For more on this, we're joined by Kavitha Davison, sports writer and correspondent on HBO's Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel. Welcome back to the show, Kavitha.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
Let me start with the biggest question of all. Should we be playing professional sports full stop in a global pandemic?
I mean, this is the ongoing question. I feel like we've had this conversation a lot over the last going on 3 years now, unfortunately. I mean, should we be playing sports? Should restaurants be open? You know, should kids be in school? There are all of these questions, and I frankly don't really know the answer to that. Health officials are saying it's okay with certain protocols, and one of those protocols is making sure everybody is vaccinated, which is why certain athletes' refusal to get the shot kind of puts the whole thing in jeopardy.
Look, as a college professor at a D1 school, I watch athletes all the time bend to all kinds of rules that simply are requirements of their capacity to play, full stop. Like, whether they want to or not, they must do A, B, and C in order to play. Why is there so much movement on the margins here around this COVID vaccine?
I think it's because it's become a political issue. And I hate using that word because I think everything can be characterized as a political issue these days. But I think it's become a fire starter. And if you see the way that, for example, Novak Djokovic and his father are going to the press about this, this has become an issue of freedom and tyranny and personal responsibility and all of that, instead of exactly what you said, which is athletes subject themselves to all kinds of things beyond just what the government requires of them all the time, whether it's performance enhancing drug testing and whatnot. So I'm not really sure why this is the line that is being drawn, but I think it's indicative of something larger in our culture.
Okay, so, you know, when you bring up performance enhancing drugs, let me just ask, is it possible, right, that athletes are also just concerned about how anything that is relatively new in the world could affect their bodies, given that their bodies are the way that they earn their living?
I think that's completely valid. I think that every athlete has the individual right to be concerned and to ask questions about exactly what they do put into their bodies. Now, that said, I don't say this flippantly. Some athletes do put some ridiculous things into their bodies, believing that they will help them. Legal things, I should say, like the Tom Brady diet is a little wacky, you know, if you ask me. But that being said, as each individual athlete has that right, they also have the right to to have professional medical advice given to them. And I, you know, they're just, there's such a consensus around the safety of these vaccines. And yeah, there are some side effects, but that getting COVID is actually worse. And frankly, what we've seen COVID outbreaks in various leagues over the last several months. A COVID outbreak is basically what necessitated the Nets to bring Kyrie Irving back. So there are just so many questions here about where people are drawing the line and why. But yes, every athlete does have the right to do that.
So it's one thing to have the right to make a choice not to put substances wacky or FDA approved in one's body. But, you know, obviously COVID is a public health crisis, right? So it's not just a choice you're making for yourself. And I suppose I'm a little surprised when it comes to athletes, and maybe this is my naivety. But again, you know, one of the reasons we hear, for example, as parents about why we should let our kids play in team sports, even when sometimes there may be potential injury, is that it teaches them all kinds of lessons. And that one of those lessons of team sport in particular is to make the self less important and the crew more important. Why is that not coming through here?
Yeah, I hate to say this. I think this is something very unique to American culture, is that we take our pride and individualism to a little bit of an extreme. And the compromises that we've had to make for the collective good, whether it's getting the vaccine or otherwise, or wearing masks, you know, these aren't difficult decisions for people in other cultures and other countries to make. I point to South Korea all the time. South Korea, which, by the way, ranks higher than the United States in the democracy index, so nobody can say anything there. South Koreans mask and get the shot and social distance, you know, when they're asked to, because it is better for the collective good. And I agree with you that so much of the benefit of participating in a team sport is learning that camaraderie and teamwork and sportsmanship and all of that. That being said, you know, I do maintain the right of each individual athlete to maintain, you know, their independence and their individuality there. And I think, for example, one of the disappointments with LeBron James, for example, is while he is vaccinated and he finally did come out and confirm that, you know, here's a player who has such a platform, who has used his platform for so much good, and he's just refused to use that platform, as is his right, to advocate for people getting the vaccine. And he would be speaking to a community that could use that advice, I think. So it is a difficult question here. And it does kind of come back to, what is the responsibility of these athletes to be public figures? I think sometimes we overstate that because, you know, if you look at some of the overall numbers, you know, the NBA before the season started, we were all talking about Kyrie not being vaxxed before the season. But before the season, 96% of the NBA was vaccinated. And at that same time, only 68% of the NYPD was. So maybe we should be talking about that instead.
Listen, your capacity to the recitation of those in context vaccination numbers, as well as your ability to tell us where South Korea and the U.S. stand in relative measure on the democracy index, it's part of why around here at The Takeaway, we just call you Kavitha the Great. And so knowing that you were going to be on the show today, we got some serious Yankees fans on the team. Mm-hmm. And they said, even if we were talking about Novak, we had to pause and ask you about the Yankees naming a woman as a manager of one of their minor league teams.
Yeah, Rachel Balcovec. And, you know, I'm born and raised in New York. I grew up a Yankee fan. I have a Yankee tattoo, so I feel this in my bones, you know. I think I tweeted this yesterday when she had her introductory press conference. My mom, who is a 72-year-old woman from India who did not grow up watching baseball and now loves the Yankees because of me, was texting me all day about how exciting this was, that we have a woman managing a minor league team now and hopefully on the path to managing a major league team. It's a huge breakthrough. And, you know, on the one hand, suddenly we got a bunch of dudes who have never had opinions on minor league managers in their life having an opinion about Rachel. And on the other hand, you know, it is such a step forward. And she was so confident and unfazed in this press conference. And of course, she got asked, understandably, a lot of questions about what it's like to be a woman and what kind of a, you know, responsibility she carries. And she said very plainly, you know, I have two jobs. One of those jobs is being a good manager and prepping these guys, hopefully, for major league careers. And my other job is continuing to pave the way for women and making sure I do a good enough job that women not only see me as a role model, but that there are other, this opens up other opportunities to other women. And she knows that, that that's the responsibility, and it might be unfair. But hopefully we, you know, we stop needing to have firsts, but it's extremely exciting. You know, I think Yankee fans have a lot of frustrations with the way the team is being handled right now. But this is something that we can point to with pride for sure.
I love that one of the jobs of being the first is to make sure that you're not the last. Kavitha the Great Davidson is a sports writer and correspondent on HBO's Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. Thanks so much, Kavitha.
Thank you, Melissa.
Welcome to my world. Won't you come on?
It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I'm sending up three cheers for the return of the Netflix docuseries, Cheer. Season 2 is here, and it's going to be tough not to binge this season as the Navarro cheer team hits the mat once more to face extreme physical demands and emotional challenges on the path to the 2021 National Cheer Competition in Daytona.
We're going to do a skills check. We're going to try people in different spots. Friday, we'll have Matt try out.
Some of those last spots are going to be a battle, but your attitude will make or break you. And if the attitude's not good, you won't be going to Daytona.
Now, as a former middle school and high school cheerleader myself, I'm familiar with the teamwork, dedication, and athleticism required for this sport. I mean, not that I was ever cheering at this level, but I can't help but hold my breath when I watch one of our favorite celebrities get thrown 40 feet in the air. Or how when a stunt doesn't go according to plan and someone lands face first on the mat. But it's the backstories about overcoming personal obstacles and tapping into an almost superhuman drive that suck me in and make me root for this team and its butt-kicking coach, Monica Aldama. For more on what to expect in season 2 of Cheer, I spoke with the show's director and executive producer, Greg Whiteley. He started off by telling me why he decided to follow the cheer team on the show.
We had created a show called Last Chance U, and this was about 6 years ago. And the first season of the show was a relative hit, and so we were commissioned to shoot a second season of the show. It was set in Scuba, Mississippi, and we were nervous. Like, how do we make the second season different than the first season? And we noticed that there was a cheer squad on the sideline of every game that we're filming, and we didn't know anything about them. And so we just made the decision to go attend one of their practices. And it was strangely intense. They were doing stunts, and they were doing a routine that we never saw on the sidelines of either football or basketball games. And when we asked them about this, they said, oh, yeah, we've never do these on the sideline of the game because they're just too dangerous. And we're saving them for Daytona. Well, what's Daytona? And as soon as they
what's Daytona?
Yeah, I did not know. I mean, I really did not know anything about the world of cheer. And so when they explained what Daytona was, it sounded like a show.
Talk to me a little bit about the criticism of the series, that it glorifies extreme physical sacrifice, right? Young people willing to go out there with smiles on their faces despite their physical pain.
I think Monica was criticized. Monica, the coach of the Navarro college team, the first season of the show, she received a lot of criticism for putting kids in danger. And there's a historian that we interview in the show who makes the point that why isn't anybody calling out Nick Saban? Monica has won more national championships than Nick Saban has. And yet when there is a football player, a quarterback that goes down with a shoulder injury, or somebody in a national championship game gets an ACL tear in their knee, nobody's blaming the coach, and hardly anybody is blaming the sport. And I can't help but wonder why. What's the difference? Why is cheerleading being criticized? It also should be noted, too, that there are certain governing bodies in the sport of cheer that have made changes to it in the last 5 or 10 years to make it safer, to try and ensure that coaches and people associated with the sport are trained in the proper way to help mitigate injuries. But I think there is something inherent in the sport of cheerleading that calls for its participants to press certain boundaries and do more and more difficult stunts And it's very difficult to do that without incurring some risk. I'm all for doing whatever you can to make it safer for its participants. But I have noted that there is a disparity in the way that we treat the risk you assume when you cheerlead versus the risk you assume when you play any other sport.
Now, I want to talk about what I think is an even more difficult and certainly legitimate critique and or concern. Jerry Harris was arrested for child pornography. For those of you all who were working on the show, when this news broke, what impact did it have?
I think the way that at least I personally processed it, it felt very much like someone who I knew and admired and loved had died. I personally speaking, I remember really the whole event when the news hit was completely disorienting. I think I spent a month just having a difficult time even admitting that it had happened. I know that there was others around me who work with me who felt similar. When we went to go back and film a second season, it was an event that was impossible to ignore, obviously, not just because of the coverage it had received, but because of the way that it affected the team. And as documentarians, our job is to tell the story of the Navarro cheer team. And that event had such a profound effect on everybody associated with that team, we had to account for it and tell that story. I'm so grateful for the teammates, people who lived with Jerry and knew Jerry well, who graciously and generously sat for hours of questions on our part to try and get to the bottom of how this could have happened without people knowing it.
So as I listen to you as a filmmaker, your gratitude and humility in the face of your subjects, the depth of your curiosity about the fundamental question of cheering, but then all of the world that is part of it, your engagement with the history of the sport, I feel like I already know the answer to my final question, but I'll ask it anyway. Why do you think this series is just so compelling?
Boy, if you think you know the answer to that, I'd love for you to tell me. Here's what I think is at least one reason why people find this show interesting. I think there is something about an individual that is willing to allow themselves to be thrown 40 feet in the air over and over and over again, and then trust that they're going to be caught by a peer, a teammate, over and over again. And then in some instances, when that doesn't work out and you land face first on the mat, and assuming you avoid serious injury, how many times I see that individual get right back up and try the same thing over again. I just think that is a rare human quality. I don't know that I have that. I don't have that fearlessness, that courage, or that willingness to endure that kind of physical pain. But I love to watch people who do. And there is a strange combination in your prototypical cheerleader of grit and determination and optimism that I think is compelling.
Greg Whiteley, director and executive producer of Cheer on Netflix. Thank you for articulating what I've known since I was 13. Cheerleaders will save us all. And thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's so good to be with you, Melissa. Thank you.
Well, folks, that's the show today. And let me send some love to my sorors of Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, Incorporated, founded on this day in 1913 at Howard University. Happy Founders Day, y'all. And especially some love to the Pi Omicron chapter where I was made. I know COVID has made it challenging to be the Pi Omicron chapter of Delta. But don't worry, y'all. We know who we are. Now, remember, if you have any show ideas or suggestions, or you know someone doing something transformative and you think we should send them a shout out, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Ooh, y'all.